Good evening, friends, and thanks for tuning in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where tonight we're asking, how much does it cost to play Happy Birthday? That song you thought that no one had written and no one could own, well, they did, but it became part of public domain after several years of being dragged through the courts. We'll discuss what this means and a few other contentious musical cases from the past few decades.
The conclusion of this case was, if you own a really valuable song from 100 years ago, find the paperwork that proves that you definitely own it.
And while we're on the subject of owning things you thought were priceless, we'll turn our attention to the colour black. To be specific, Vanta Black, a new material that could lay claim to be the ultimate black and something that's causing quite a stir in the art world. That's all coming up on today's episode of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. The crux of today's show is all pegged on this popular song. For years, film and TV producers have been trying to get around the rights of this tricky tune, often by changing the words or notes, or singing something completely different. Happy Birthday has been the punchline of many on-screen jokes about paying royalties. However, all that has now changed. In early February, Happy Birthday was declared public domain after a long court battle where the Warner Chappell Music Group lost the rights to the track after their claim was deemed invalid. Today we're going to use this story as a springboard to talk about a few other musical misadventures that have left people in a tizzy about rights to their own compositions. And to talk me through a few of them is Chris Cook, co-founder and business editor of the Complete Music Update.
Warner Chappell, which is the music publishing division of Warner Music, was under the impression that it owned the copyright in Happy Birthday. It acquired it in the 80s. So obviously everyone knows the song, Happy Birthday. It's generally referred to as the most sung song in the world. Yeah. I don't know if that's true, but that's the line that is wheeled out. And it was written by two sisters in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Exactly when, we don't know, which is part of the problem with this case, that these two sisters wrote the song. They assigned some of the copyright to a publishing company, which then got bought by Warner in the 80s. Outside of the US, it is still in copyright for another year.
Wait, so we can't break into song here now in the UK?
Unless you had a license from the correct organisation.
Have you got a license for that song? Okay.
Because copyright normally is the life of the creator and then another, well, in Europe, another 70 years. Mm-hmm. And it's 70 years this year since the eldest of the sisters who wrote this song died. So we've still got another year to go in Europe. In the US, songs that old, the copyright term rules, all come from the earlier 20th century where it was very complicated and it kept changing. And because we don't quite know, it's the lyrics actually that were at the heart of this.
Yeah.
Because we don't quite know when the lyrics were written, it may be in copyright or it may not be in copyright. Anyway, a film producer decided that it wasn't, took it to court. Warner Chappell fought the case but lost on summary judgment. And as part of the settlement, they have agreed that in the US, Happy Birthday is now public domain. By their original maths, it would have had another 15 years to run. Estimates are that Happy Birthday was worth about $2 million a year to Warner Chappell. So that's quite a lot of money that they're giving up. Yeah. By agreeing, all right, then, in the US it's out of copyright and in Europe it'll be out of copyright by the end of the year anyway.
With what interest was this greeted in the music industry, Chris? Because it's kind of, it's a test case. I mean, it might be the world's most famous song. It's certainly one of those songs that seems like it was plucked out of the ether rather than ever having been written. It seems so essential to us, at least in the West. Did it kind of prick your memory into thinking, hang on, this has happened, this is just the sort of tip of an iceberg, a sort of copyright iceberg?
It's interesting in that a lot of this case was about the confusion as to exactly who wrote the lyrics, because the original version of the song had different lyrics, which is part of the problem. And then it was the paper trail, and the people who were trying to argue it was out of copyright were desperately trying to find books from the early 20th century which had early versions of the song to prove it wasn't in copyright. Mm. So it's a very paperwork case. I suppose a lot of the other really famous copyright cases are more where there's a dispute between two songwriters as to who wrote the song, or one songwriter accuses another songwriter of ripping them off. And I suppose those are the cases which are in some ways more interesting and potentially set a more dangerous precedent. I think the conclusion of this case was, if you own a really valuable song from 100 years ago, find the paperwork that proves that you definitely own it, which clearly Warner did not do enough due diligence back in the 80s. Whereas when it comes to two songwriters disagreeing over who originally wrote a song, well, that's a much more grey area. And often with those cases, it is quite hard to work out who is right and who is wrong.
Well, you flagged us up with some really good examples, actually. Great songs, all of them, all, some of them are very great. We'll kick off with a genuinely great one, Men at Work, great Australian band, Land Down Under. Tell us about this one, Chris, because this, people quite, I think I was quite shocked when I heard the truth,
yes,
the awful truth.
Well, you, if you remember that song, and if not, go and find it on the internet, it'll be there somewhere, have a listen to it. There's a little bit of a flute in the middle of it, which actually is some notes from a song which you may have sung at school back in the day. It's called Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree, I think that's what it's called. That's a traditional Australian song, and it's so traditionally Australian that Men at Work sort of adopted that little riff because it immediately sounds Australian.
Yeah,
that was fine for about 28 years. No one had a problem with that. And then suddenly the publisher who owns the copyright in that traditional song suddenly stepped forward and said, hang on a second, you never got our permission to use those five or six notes of this really famous song. That's such a famous riff. It really has an important role in your song, and they sued for copyright infringement. There was then, like the Happy Birthday case, there was then an argument over, did that publishing company actually own the copyright? This was another song that was written by some woman 100 years ago in a competition organised by the Girl Guides of Australia. And so the
some good facts here, Chris Cook.
So the legal representative for Men at Work said, this woman who claimed that she owned the copyright and who had assigned it to this publishing company years later, if she'd read the terms and conditions of the competition, the Girl Guides owned the song. So there was a big dispute over who owned the copyright. In the end, Men at Work lost on that argument. The court said, no, this publishing company does properly own this copyright. Therefore, they are due a cut. You then have the second stage, which is, well, what cut?
So then, you know, there's an idea then of having to backdate royalties and things like that,
yes,
and how far do you backdate them? That's presumably a very tricky area legally.
It is. So, yeah, how big a cut are you giving them, and are you backdating it all the way back to the beginning of time? On this case, actually, they were pushing for 50%, which is quite bold for what is a tiny little segment of the song. They didn't
look at the
get
Girl Guides in different lights now.
Oh, it wasn't the Girl Guides, to be fair. They washed their hands of it. It was the publisher who owned the copyright. And they only got 5%, and they only got it backdated a certain number of years, I think about 2002. And that's still, for a song that gets played all over the world, that's still a significant chunk of money, but it's not quite as much money as they were hoping for.
And we'll move on to a couple of other examples in a sec, but you mentioned something interesting there in talking about Men at Work and Down Under and that flute figure in the middle of that song. And you said that it was deemed to be valuable because it was essential to that song holding together as a great tune. Is that part of it as well? I'm kind of thinking of one of my favourite songs is Yes, I'm Your Angel by Yoko Ono from the Double Fantasy record. You hear her walking into a room, like a sort of Parisian bistro or something, and there is a band playing something that might be Gershwin, who knows, or something in the background. That's not essential to that song. It's just a bit of mood music to fake walking into a room. Is something like that a grey area? Would you have to ask permission, I wonder, for something like that?
If you were to actually take the recording and sample it, then for definite, the recording will be protected by copyright. Whether the concept of having the recording of someone, if you were to record someone else walking, well, that's a grey area there. Mike Batt once got in trouble. So Mike Batt, who's
the Wombles,
best known, I mean, does a lot of
Casey
stuff,
Mello.
But best known for the Wombles. And on one of his albums, he had a track of silence. And obviously the composer most famous for composing A Piece of Silence is John Cage.
Yeah.
And that's a very famous work. And Mike Batt was then sued for this piece of silence. He sort of walked into it by putting in brackets something like inspired by John Cage or co-crediting John Cage. So I think if he hadn't done that, it wouldn't have been an issue. But he was then sued for basically nicking the concept there that silence could be a composition and a piece of music. That's a rare case. I mean, usually, yes, if you took the recording for definite, you would need permission. If you took the concept, it would be a much harder argument in court.
Yeah, it's a tough one. That's a great one. We better keep the conversation going so we don't lapse into any radio silence.
And sued by the estate of John Cage.
Exactly. Okay, we'll do a couple more of your examples, Chris, before we finish up. Procol Harum's White Shade of Pale. One of the kind of cornerstones of the rock canon, you know, you might think. But it's not quite as simple as we think, is it? Tell us about this.
No, so this was a dispute between two members of the band.
Yeah.
So Gary Brooker, who was the main composer of all the Procol Harum's music, owned 100% the copyright in that track. But then the organist from the band then stepped forward. I mean, again, this is another case that happened decades after the record had been released, came forward and said, well, actually, when Gary came to the studio with this song, the most famous bit of that song is the organ bit at the start. And his argument was, Gary hadn't written that. He just said, oh, do something a bit like this. And I sat on the organ and I did that. And actually, technically, that's my composition. Mm. and therefore I should have a cut of the royalties. And bearing in mind, this all sort of happened when ringtones were big. And it was a really popular ringtone. And I think what got to him was the bit of the song that people had as a ringtone was his bit. And he wasn't getting any of the royalties from that. And so he went to court, and it was one of those that went from lower court to appeal court all the way up to the House of Lords, which at that point was the highest court of appeal in the UK. And it was agreed ultimately that, yes, he had written that bit and then he should have some royalties. There was then a debate about had he left it too long. And one of the courts said, we think you own a cut of this money, but you've left it too long, so therefore you can't have any. And ultimately, they decided, yes, actually, I think he ended up with 40% of the song, 40% of the royalties. And this is a track that really
it's
is
a mega song, isn't it?
On radio stations all over the world every day. Although, again, it was only backdated, I think, to around about the time he initially sued. So it wasn't all the way back for the 40 years that the record had been at. Apart from that, would just be, who's going to do the maths?
Yeah.
The record industry and the music publishing sector, certainly back in the day, was not best known for their paperwork. And how would you work out what the money was 40 years back?
We're going to bring it bang up to date, Chris, to end with Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams' Blurred Lines. Controversial for various reasons, in fact.
Yeah, the Blurred Lines, yeah, was controversial way before the copyright case kicked off. This was a Marvin Gaye track called Got to Give Up. It was another example of the artist sort of walking into the dispute, because Robin Thicke gave an interview where he was talking about the creative process behind the track. And he said, oh, well, I went into the studio with Pharrell and I said to Pharrell, one of my favourite songs is Marvin Gaye, Got to Give It Up. Why don't we do something like that? And then everyone read that article and said, yeah, he
gosh,
just...
it is quite similar.
he just took that track. So then there was rumours going around the Marvin Gaye estate were going to sue. So Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams took the initial action and they sued to try and get court clarification that there wasn't infringement, which then opened it up and the Gaye estate sued. And it was a big case. Robin Thicke was on the piano in court trying to convince the jury. Because in the US, copyright cases go for a jury.
That good one to be on the jury.
Wouldn't happen in the UK. It did in the US. And they lost. I mean, they are appealing, so there may well be another ruling to come. But as it currently stands, half of the money generated by Blurred Lines, which is whatever you think of that song, and I happen to think lyrically it's a terrible, horrible song, but huge hit. I mean, one of the biggest hits.
And a total earworm. I mean, one of those ones.
Exactly.
Yeah. But maybe the reason for it is because
Marvin
it's that Marvin Gaye.
Exactly.
Before we go, Chris, we sort of mentioned samples, we mentioned hip-hop. That, when it was sort of born in the early 80s as a genre, as rap music, I guess, which was all about samples, what's the history of that? I mean, was that just easy? A lot of it was public performance, and then it obviously became put on records. But was that a grey area? Is there a lot of ill-at-ease legality over the dawn of hip-hop, as it were?
And continues to this day. And I mean, if you are a label putting out hip-hop and you have an artist, he works on like DJ Shadow, who will have like hundreds of samples in one track. Technically, if you want to cover yourself, you have to go and get a deal for every single one of them. You have to go to every single record company, every publisher. That's a lot of work. There is an element of, though, with new talent in hip-hop always, the way new artists work is they put out these mixtapes, which used to be literally on a cassette, and now they just put them out on SoundCloud or whatever. And generally, when kids are just putting out stuff to sort of build a profile and they're not making any money out of it, there's nothing to stop a label coming forward and suing you, or at the very least taking your content down, but generally everyone turns a blind eye, because it would be hypocritical of Eminem to stop some kid from sampling his music when that is how he launched his career back in the early 90s. So generally people turn a blind eye, but the minute you become big or trying to commercialize that content. I mean, basically, you only sue rich people, don't you? The minute you see that there is some money being made, that is the point where, at the very least, you would cease and desist, or you might actually go after for a chunk of the change. We do lots of copyright training stuff, and we do education stuff with new artists, and that is always, I mean, a lawyer would say, always cover your back, but there will always be a point to which everyone will ignore you, but the minute there's money, someone might step forward. So it is worth being careful when you're putting your stuff out there.
Chris Cook, co-founder and business editor of The Complete Music Update. After the break, we'll be finding out who owns the new black. Stay tuned.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
So we've explored the annals of elemental tunes and who owns them in the first half of the programme, and now we're going to stay on that thought but take a right fork into the world of art and wonder if you can own a colour. More specifically, a new sort of blacker than black black. The art world is all riled up at the moment by the news that the sculptor, Anish Kapoor, has acquired the artistic rights to a new material called Vantablack, the blackest substance known, which absorbs almost all light and heat. It's a strange and mysterious material which is used in defence, aviation and technology, but when applied to art, plays with the ideas of colour and depth. Plenty has been said on the matter, much of it of the how dare he side of things, but we think that it opens up a fascinating question of ownership and aesthetics. For the rest of today's show, we'll be delving right in to get the legal and artistic perspectives on this storm in a paint pot.
My immediate reaction was just sad, really. I think the art world's very free-thinking, open access, you know, a well-shared world. And if we didn't share things, we wouldn't ever develop anything creative at all.
Carolyn Black runs Flow Contemporary Arts, and she's one of the voices who've spoken out against Anish Kapoor's rights over Vantablack.
I suppose I don't really understand why anyone would want to limit the use of something that's quite groundbreaking, actually. It's totally beyond me why, you know, it would be like saying, well, I invented Velcro and you can only use it on black shoes or, you know, on coats, but you must never use it on trousers. It's just a strange way to think about creation and invention, isn't it?
The reaction to the recent news has been mostly along the lines of why should one artist own the exclusive rights to a material? However, Anish Kapoor himself hasn't commented on the deal that's been struck with the developers Surrey Nanosystems, and so it seems there's an obvious blank in the story which we're trying to fill in today. So first of all, the legals and a confusion between copyright and patent, says Rosie Burbage, intellectual property lawyer at London law firm Fox Williams.
I've read a lot about it being a copyright issue, which is completely incorrect. And I think copyright often gets labelled as being this very wide-ranging right that prevents all sorts of things. In my experience, that is completely not the case. The idea that Anish Kapoor owns a particular type of right, a particular type of black, that's not the case. Actually, this is a patent, and it's not a patent for a paint or a pigment. It's a patent for a particular material, and it's a material that's created by a series of nanostructures done on a very, very, very small scale. It's like having loads of little tubes that connect up together in a kind of coral-like substance. And the idea is that all of these tubes stop light from being able to escape the surface of whatever it's coated with. So that creates the effect of being a very, very dark substance. That's the number one thing. This is nothing to do with copyright. This is a patent issue. And the patent is owned by a company called Surrey Nanosystems, who developed it for all sorts of things totally unrelated to the art world, mostly linked to defence, so the sort of concept of hiding objects, because if you can coat something with this substance, you can't see the sort of surface of it very easily, and you can hide details behind the way that a particular object in the defence world looks. the idea behind a patent is that it protects an invention, so something that is perhaps more scientifically clever than creatively clever. And what we're starting to see is more crossover between the applications. And I think that's where Anish Kapoor sort of steps into the picture, really.
Okay, so that's cleared up. But why Anish Kapoor? Could anyone have got the rights to this substance? Or was there only one man for the job? This isn't necessarily something we can answer for sure, but we can certainly muse on it. Ossian Ward, head of content at Listen Gallery, who represents Anish Kapoor, puts the choice of artist into context and explains why he thinks this partnership might have been formed. We should note that he's not speaking on behalf of Kapoor, just himself.
From the very first works that he made, loose pigment was a factor. So he would cover sculptures in loose pigment, usually reds and blues. And he's been experimenting with colour and pigment ever since. So to the point where he can actually cover works or these dishes he makes or different shapes that protrude or recede into a wall. And by pigmenting them, covering them with loose pigment or attached pigment, there seems to be this extra void, or you're not quite sure where the void begins, or, you know, how far this recess goes, how deep it goes. Could you put your arm in that? You know, would you get lost in space if you sort of dived into one? So in a funny kind of way, Anish has already perfected much of this technique that we're talking about. Now, the idea that there could be a black that was even more, let's say, kind of mysterious or ethereal, that there was no light in there, that nothing was bouncing off, you know, I think that's a challenge for him, because actually he uses the fact of the light and the play of shape and solid and form and void to make these works. So what happens when there's nothing there, when it seems like it's totally flat?
And there is that thing, maybe he's wise in not talking about this yet, that there's the simple thing that people maybe have overlooked in this discussion about Vantablack and about Anish Kapoor's usage of it, that there's the simple joy of getting a new thing, you know, a new colour or a new substance, and throwing lots of mud at the wall and seeing what sticks, I suppose. I mean, there's that idea that artists, you know, the playful aspect of artists, of wondering what it will look like at the end. I mean, that, are we slightly losing sight of that in this discussion, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, in terms of the exclusive nature of it, that other artists can't get hold of it. I mean, I think that's also a bit of a red herring, because Richard Prince tweeted that he had a whole stash of it that he got from the military and that he didn't know what to do with it. So if anyone wanted any, they were welcome to it. So, you know, and I know Richard Prince has covered his car bonnet hoods and cars in this kind of weird ethereal looking paint. So maybe that's what he was going to do with it. But
he's still got some left in his garage.
We can go around.
We can invite listeners to go around Richard's garage.
Paint a private jet in it and see where that gets you. No, I mean, I think the applications are very, you know, early days for the applications of it, and the real applications, you know, the fact that you could grow it, or, you know, it's super heat resistant and go into space with it, make it difficult to just, you know, throw it at the wall and see what sticks, because I think, you know, the applications and the way it works as a material for an artist are going to be totally different, you know, using it as a pigment. But yeah, the idea that there's this kind of extra void, you know, it's always been something in art history that artists have looked for, that the new technology or the new colour or their obsession with perhaps the difficulty of attaining something like lapis lazuli that was super expensive and only came from Afghanistan, or certain types of Prussian blue or black that weren't easily attainable, or, you know, the way that they used to make pigments from all kinds of different materials and, you know, ground paste. And, you know, it was kind of something alchemical about it. And I think, yes, we may have lost sight of the fact that there could still be this kind of wondrous material that we haven't discovered yet, rather than worrying about who can have it or
who can't. Yeah.
The applications are sort of endless. And the way I see it is that in some kind of way, Anish Kapoor has actually been invited more to use this. You know, they've been looking for partners and artistic partners to work on it. So the latest we've heard is that an architect has also been approached to use this material. So I don't know about the exclusivity of it exactly, but I think it's not commercially available. You can't go to the shops to buy it. So the idea that one artist might be using it rather than everyone else is what's got everyone riled up. But I believe, you know, it's more like being an artist in residence, and here you go, here's this amazing stuff, see what you can do with it.
But Kapoor isn't the first artist to claim rights to something. Ever had that moment when you just can't find the perfect shade of blue? Well, Yves Klein felt the same and developed his very own unique colour in the 1960s.
Yves Klein, you know, made this statement that this IKB was his own pigment and probably, you know, he patented it. But, you know, he was also famed for putting on shows with nothing on it or putting on shows of all the same, exact same blue paintings, all with different prices. So he was testing out to see, you know, how far he could push the market or the exhibition. Or so the idea that you could own a colour was what he was really interested in. He was also interested in the void. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, some of those IKB pigmented works where the sort of the surface is very, you know, difficult to grasp or attain, and the colour and the surface is really important for those paintings, is a lot of what Anish has been practicing with. But I think the idea that an artist could copyright one sort of or own their own thing is an artistic statement. You know, artists are only as good as their idea, because artists don't even own their ideas. You know, you see it all the time, they're being taken by advertising. The idea that the artist is, you know, in charge of some pure original fount of all knowledge is also kind of a fabrication, because they're also using art history and they're using other sources. So the idea that they have this copyright TM behind them is impossible to kind of say.
But this case is different. Yves Klein owned the patent, which you lose after 20 years. In this case, Surrey Nanosystems owns the patent, and Anish Kapoor has exclusive rights here in the UK. Here's Rosie again to explain.
He's got a license, an exclusive license, to use it for artistic uses. So that's a relatively limited license. When you've got a proprietary technology like this, very often companies aren't willing to license it because they might want to either keep their particular sector that they're working with, say the aviation sector. They might not feel very comfortable with it being used artistically. Given this is quite a sensitive area potentially as far as defence is concerned, it's actually quite surprising in some ways that it's being licensed for artistic use, which generally has a very public-facing aspect to it. I mean, most artists aren't going to want to keep it in their studio. They want to share it with the world. And that can cause problems, potentially, for the defence sector. Again, it comes back to just the general excitement at this being a shared thing. I don't see it at all as something that's being limited to a particular artist. I see it as a very exciting thing that it's being shared with the artistic world at all.
So Vantablack isn't solely up for Kapoor's grabs. It's still to be used in architecture, on aeroplanes, in telescopes, and even in space. There's plenty of room for innovation and creativity with this material. It just seems a little more condensed in the art world. But is this a bad thing? Without Kapoor's deal, this might not even have entered the art world, says Rosie Burbage. And it's an exciting venture between science and art. And let's face it, we're all looking forward to seeing Anish Kapoor enter the void and come up with something fascinating.
The fact that Surrey Nanosystems has decided to license it for artistic works will, I hope, start a new trend, and the artistic community can only benefit from this in the long run.
All right, so we might have a case of shooting first and asking questions later in the art world. We hope we've filled you in. All eyes will be peeled for Anish Kapoor's first work using this weird and wonderful, not to say contentious, new material. We hope you've enjoyed this regional stopping service through the hills of Happy Birthday and the dales of Vantablack. Should you be careful what you whistle on the way to work or what you get on the end of your paintbrush? No way. We've tried to make the fine print bold. We hope we've made the technical technicolor. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was always the new black, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thanks for tuning in.